For the first time ever, fracking is coming to Illinois. We check in with people in the southern Illinois town of Enfield, some of whom say it could boost the economy, and others who are concerned about environmental risks. Plus, more athletes are speaking out about their struggles with mental health, including WNBA player Imani Boyette.
When you're in a position of privilege, which most athletes are, it's hard to explain that everything may not be okay. It's definitely hard as an athlete to speak out about mental health because, no one can see what the problem is.
And community members in LaSalle County spent 7 months rebuilding a nursing home that was hit by a tornado, and now they finally reopen.
We're all very, very happy. It's a home again, not a ghost town like it was.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo today. For the first time ever, the Illinois Department of Natural Resources has approved a permit for a company to perform the controversial oil drilling practice of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. This move comes more than 4 years after former Governor Pat Quinn signed a law that opened the way for fracking to take place in Illinois. The permit has been granted to Woolsey Operating Company, based in Wichita, Kansas, and the drilling is expected to begin in and around the southern Illinois village of Enfield in White County. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Enfield's village president, who says this is good news for the local economy. We'll also speak with a resident who lives close to the well site and says he's concerned about the risk of contamination. But first, we're joined on the line by Molly Parker. She's a reporter with the Southern Illinoisan based in Carbondale. Molly, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you.
As I mentioned, Molly, 4 years passed between the time Governor Quinn signed the Illinois Hydraulic Fracturing Regulatory Act into law and the time of this first permit. What took so long for this permit to get issued?
Well, there was a lot of pushback, even in Southern Illinois. Our local lawmakers, Representative Bradley and others, helped lead the charge on this law. But there were a number of groups, including a group called Safe Southern Illinoisans Against Fracturing Our Environment and others who came together to push back. The great number of people pushing back against this law flooded IDNR with comments, questions, and so on during the regulatory process. And they took a great deal of time, I think about a year and a half, to finalize the regulations. So the legislature, it's one thing to have the law, but then the JCAR Joint Committee on Rules has to then pass the rules for this law. And so really no one could be issued a permit until that took place, even though Governor Quinn signed that law in 2013. By the time that happened, by the time they issued those rules, there was this a feeling that they had sort of missed the window. There were fracking had taken off in other places, and the need had diminished in our country. And so you didn't see the oil companies, rushing to file these permits. There were two pending applications, and they just sat there for quite some time. We've obviously seen that first permit just being issued just now. So there were sort of two things at play. One, just how long it took to write the rules and regulations and get those approved. And then two, there was that just the economy at work, and they missed that window. And there was just a long period of time passed before, obviously, an oil company found it advantageous to go forward. And I still think there's a lot of questions about, they talk that that's an exploratory well. There also have been questions about how much horizontal hydraulic fracturing will be beneficial in the Illinois Basin. So I think those questions are yet to be answered, but it is interesting that Woolsey is going forward with that application.
And Molly, what role did oil prices play in this whole situation as well?
Well, and that's what I'm saying. That's a sort of twofold issue, was that the oil prices dropped, and it just wasn't it didn't make sense once the law and the rules were finally in place and the companies could go forward to do this. There was not a economic benefit for these companies to do so in the Illinois Basin.
I think fracking is a technique that a lot of people have heard of, but can you remind us exactly what does it involve?
Yeah, I mean, it's a process that, they mix water, chemicals, sand, and they use just an extremely high volume of water to fracture source rock, gray, black shale that's under the ground, these rock formations, and to break them up and allowing trapped oil and gas to escape. You can do hydraulic fracturing, as I understand it, both horizontally and vertically. And in the Illinois Basin in Southeast Illinois, they have been drilling for decades, which is why you don't hear as much of a pushback in the actual areas where they're looking at putting this drill and doing this type of drilling. They are a little bit more accustomed to the oil and gas industry than we are in other parts of Illinois and Southern Illinois. But the difference is what we're talking about typically when people talk about hydraulic fracturing, it's horizontal hydraulic fracturing. So going deep, but then also, pushing the water out a long distance horizontally.
What do you see as the potential benefits of fracking to the local economy for Enfield and the surrounding area?
I mean, I think it's hard to say. Again, that permit that they talked about, and I didn't do the story. One of my colleagues did and interviewed the oil company that is doing that, and they talked specifically that this is an exploratory well, and that's what I was saying. I think there's a lot of questions still about how beneficial, how much oil they will be able to extract from horizontal hydraulic fracturing in the Illinois Basin. I think that's a big unknown. When I wrote a story in December, there were actually a lot of the oil and gas folks that I talked to were saying they didn't expect it to really ever take off in the Illinois Basin. So this is an interesting development here that they're going to give it a try. And I know they said, they said it's an exploratory phase right now. So they're going to see what happens. And I think that will depend on the economic benefit. Certainly a lot of these towns, though, are hungry for something to happen. Like much of Southern Illinois, the southeastern region has seen a lot of jobs dry up and leave with the coal industry, and also with the decline in the oil and gas industry, with prices being so low. I had gone to a community of Grayville, which is just real close to Enfield and just about, 15, 20 minutes, and spent a lot of time with the mayor there. You know, he was very enthusiastic and hopeful. They had hopes of a prison during the George Ryan administration that was dashed. And, so he was just talking about how people need jobs. Everybody's driving over the border to Indiana. And he was hopeful that fracking would bring people to their hotel in town and to the subway and, those sort of ancillary benefits. So I feel like it's too soon to say. I know people are hopeful and eager for any signs of economic benefit in our region for anything.
And Molly, on the other side, you mentioned earlier that there have been several groups speaking out with concerns about the risks of contamination to land and drinking water. From what you've been able to tell through your reporting here, how serious are these risks?
Well, I know that people's concerns are genuine, and there are volumes of research on this. And I am not going to pretend to be an expert on the science and the risks, but there again, that's why people have been so concerned. And even in this latest permitting, I think there were 10,000 commenters to IDNR opposing this. People are concerned about groundwater contamination. We sit on the New Madrid Fault, so there's concerns about earthquakes. How likely are those things? I don't know. But again, there are volumes of research out there indicating that, there are risks. We're not breaking ground in Southern Illinois, no pun intended here, but this isn't new here. You can look at what has happened in some of these other communities. And again, people feel very passionately about this on both sides of the issue. I think one of the big concerns is the disposal of the wastewater. And I'm not entirely clear on how this permit calls for that to be done, but that's one of the big issues is you're using such high volumes of water. You then have to dispose of that water that has, a mixture of chemicals in it. And so there's a lot of concerns. I've also heard that this is one of the strictest fracking laws in the country. So, obviously, if they go forward with it, I think we'll all be hopeful that that those regulations are taken very seriously by the state.
Molly Parker, reporter with the Southern Illinois. And Molly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And let's go now to Mona Weaver. She lives near Enfield and owns land that's about 3 miles from the drilling site. Mona, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, Mona, what was your reaction to the news that Woolsey Energy was granted a permit to begin fracking in Enfield?
Well, I don't like it. I absolutely don't want my... As I told the other lady, we farm for a living all of our life, and now our grandchildren are farming. They've got a lot of animals, and I don't want the water contaminated, and I call it poison.
Yeah.
I own 600 and 3 acres. I own the mineral rights. My husband and I still live in the same old house, and December will be here on our farm. We still live on our farm, and December will be 70 years.
Can you tell us a little bit more about those concerns? You mentioned you're worried about the drinking water. What really worries you about this whole fracking process?
Well, we have cistern. We don't have city water, and we've got a lot of animals, and so is all of my children and grandchildren. They've got all kinds of animals, and they just don't want that water poisoned. I'll put it that way.
Sure. Now, if I understand correctly, you know, you're in the middle of a legal process to try and prevent this fracking from getting underway here. What would you like to see happen here?
Shut them down.
You mentioned, you know, that you know, you're not the only one who has some concerns about this, Mona. Did you get the sense that other people near you are also concerned about this?
Yes, right. I own the mineral rights, coal and oil, you name it, and I don't want it hurt.
So you're hearing the same thing from a lot of your friends and neighbors as well?
Yes.
All right.
But,
well,
and a lot of my family.
Okay. All right. Well, Mona, we appreciate you joining us here today on the 21st to share your concerns about hydraulic fracturing.
Well, I'm glad that I can speak. I'm very healthy, thank God. I'm 87. I'm on my own lawn, and our deer hunt day and night, almost. And I've got, well, my husband and I have got a cap. We've got 52 buttons on that cap. And a lot of times we'd go to turn one in, they'd already run without their button. But I'm still deer hunting.
All right. Well, that's great, Mona. Thank you so much for joining us here today on the 21st. That's Mona Weaver, who has some concerns about hydraulic fracturing. And now let's bring in Tom Harbor. He's the village president of Enfield, where this will take place. So before we bring Tom in, though, I want to mention that we reached out to Woolsey Energy to ask for their response to residents' concerns over possible environmental contamination. They responded with a statement that said, in part, that high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing is, quote, done every day in multiple states, and tens of thousands have been done safely and efficiently in the U.S. and in countries around the world over the last decades, end quote. They also went on to say that Illinois safety regulations are some of the toughest in the country and that they've received a permit under those regulations. We'll tweet out their full statement provided by the company if you follow us at 21STShow. We'll also have that available at our website. And now let's bring in the village president of Enfield, Tom Harbor. Tom, welcome to the 21st today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Very good information so far.
Oh, good, good. Glad you're enjoying the conversation. I'm curious, Tom, you know, what are your thoughts on having fracking come to Enfield?
Well, economics, you know, I don't really look for a huge employment opportunities, but there'll be money spent in town. Restaurants and fuel and it's my understanding that a local drilling rig in Carmi is gonna be doing the work. That's 10 miles from Enfield, so there'll be some local guys working up there, and the majority of the people want Woolsey to succeed, and there's some concerns, but I think it's kind of a little bit of a wait and see deal how it's going to work out.
Sure. Can you give us a little background on Enfield? What's your town like?
Okay, Enfield's a town of about 596 people at the last census. It's a small farming community. People work coal mines, oil field work, and and people work in Evansville, Indiana, and they also work in Mount Vernon, Indiana. And farming. Farming is the big deal here.
So you told us about what you think some of the potential benefits could be to the area. Sounds like you're maybe cautiously optimistic about that.
Yes, I am. I hope it succeeds. The United States is close to being energy independent, if this gas oil exploratory well, if it goes well, that's just another step forward.
We just heard from Mona Weaver. You mentioned that farming is a big part of the local economy there in Enfield. We just heard from Mona, who has some concerns about contamination to the water on her property. Do those risks concern you at all, Tom?
This project will probably be the most watched, inspected oil well probably ever drilled in the state of Illinois. And the inspectors will be they'll be crawling over that site,
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm very confident that things will be done the right way.
Okay. If you can, Tom, we'd like to keep talking with you here after we take this quick break. We're talking about hydraulic fracturing in the state of Illinois, the first permit issued near the village of Enfield. We'll continue our conversation with Village President Tom Harbor right after this break.
The 21st is made possible by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Propositions on Revolution, Slogans for a Future, part of the campus-wide commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moldine, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're talking about hydraulic fracturing. The first permit for fracking in the state of Illinois has been issued near the village of Enfield in the southern part of the state. And we're talking with Enfield's village president, Tom Harbor, about the project. Tom, before we went to break, you had mentioned that you're pretty confident that the regulations in place will protect residents from any risk. From your understanding, Tom, what kinds of regulations are there to just make sure that the drinking water in particular it will stay safe near Enfield?
Well, first of all, they've got to haul all this water, wastewater. They've got to haul that off, and it'll be put in pumped back in the ground and in injection well,
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna be a good sized project, and I'm sure their containment process, will be adequate, but there is so much scrutiny on this. Fracturing, that I know. I spent 41 years in a coal mine,
mm-hmm.
coal mining, and the state inspectors will be there probably constantly,
okay.
watching. And if something doesn't suit them, they're going to stop them.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't really have too many concerns about the water.
Okay. Yeah. And before we let you go here, Tom, from what you've heard from Woosley Energy, how soon will the drilling begin there near Enfield?
I think I talked to a fella in town here last night, and he works for the company that's going to drill the well, and he said sometime in mid-October is their hopefully starting date.
All right, very good.
And it'll take 4 months.
All right. Tom Harbor, the village president of Enfield in southern Illinois. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Nearly one in five Americans struggle with mental health illnesses, and according to new research, athletes might be even more prone to those struggles. A USA Today story from earlier this month featured eight professional athletes speaking up about their own battle with mental health, from former Chicago Bears wide receiver Brandon Marshall to Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympic athlete of all time. Former Chicago Sky basketball player Amani Boyette was one of those athletes who spoke out. She now plays center for the Atlanta Dream in the WNBA, and she joins us now on the phone to share her story. Amani, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You opened up about having severe depression since you were young, along with other athletes who shared their stories. Why did you want to speak out?
I think I kind of found my life's purpose in college. The first time I started speaking about not only my mental health issues, but my background and history of abuse. And I think it's just so important that we speak and use our platforms for something bigger than ourselves. And the reason mental illness and sexual abuse as well is so rampant and really one of the biggest leaders of death in our age group is because we don't talk about it. We make people feel as if they're the only ones that are going through these things, and most of us have some type of encounter with mental health and mental illness in our lifetime.
Imani, when did you first notice your own symptoms of depression?
I like to say, like, you don't know what you don't know, so I didn't know that there was something other than the way I was living. I grew up very depressed, and I always kind of felt like the black sheep, but I didn't know that the way I was living was wrong until I experienced the other side. I didn't know that I was being abused until I experienced what everyone else, how everyone else grew up. And so I can't ever say I had a happy childhood or had a happy feeling until I left home and started getting into counseling and kind of working through my issues.
Sure.
As a young adult.
Yeah. You've described moments where you felt like you should be happy, but there's kind of a fog that prevents it. Can you tell us maybe about a time in your basketball career where you should have been celebrating, but you couldn't because of that fog?
My teenage years were probably the lowest I've ever been in my life, and it was really hard for my family to understand because there was no physical symptom, you know, like you can't see it. And I was on McDonald's on American. I had a college scholarship. I got great grades at school. I was any and everything when it came to sports. So it was hard to understand why I wasn't happy. And I had a roof over my house. You know what I mean? Like, I had everything. I could check every box from the outside. But I wasn't happy because there was a lot of things that I needed to deal with that I wasn't able to or did not have the proper access to.
And, yeah, you mentioned just all those wonderful instances of your own basketball career. Do you feel like there was a turning point for you where you were able to start enjoying some of those moments?
Definitely. When I first and foremost came to terms with my own sexual abuse and the abuse I suffered growing up, that helped. And when I got to Texas, I was just surrounded by so much positivity and so much support, both on the basketball court and off the basketball court. I got into counseling and therapy on a steady basis. I got into poetry. I found positive coping mechanisms. I credit Texas as saving my life. I love that university all as well because there's great people there. There's people that care about me, not just on the basketball court, but as a human.
Does your job as an athlete make it maybe harder to tackle those depression issues head on? Is there maybe more pressure to suppress emotions like that sometimes?
I think it's really hard to explain to people who would gladly change shoes with you from the outside looking in that things aren't okay. You know, it's kind of like complaining about your leaky roof to someone who's living on the street. When you're in a position of privilege, which most athletes are, it's hard to explain that everything may not be okay. you're supposed to be happy with everything you're getting, especially as a student athlete, because you get a free education. You get the glitz, the glam, but it's also really hard, especially in 17, 18, when your identity is tied to something so much larger than you. It's tied to something that you can succeed and fail in. So it's definitely hard as an athlete to speak out about mental health because, no one can see what the problem is.
And as someone who's, you know, come up through high school, college, and now the professional ranks, I'm curious, you know, what you would recommend for young athletes, whether they be in youth basketball, high school, or college, who are struggling with their mental health while also trying to play sports?
I think it's really up to the adults in youth lives to understand that while sports are great, they can get you to inside arenas and places that many people will never be able to visit. At the end of the day, a sport is not your identity. You are so much more than an athlete. And it's important that coaches, parents alike, nurture their whole child, not just the athlete. Not just the athlete. That when I lose, it's not me. It's me losing a game. It's not a character flaw. It's not me being a bad person. And I think it's really hard to differentiate the two when you're young, especially coming up in sports, when you're supposed to be the best and you've been the best for so long.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, getting the help that you really needed when you were in college. You know, are there enough outlets available right now to maybe younger players, you know, at the youth level, at the high school level, who are dealing with some of those issues?
I don't think so, but I don't think it's just purely athletic. I don't think there's enough resources available to youth in general to talk about mental health and mental illness because we don't talk about it as a society. It's so much easier to talk about mental health and mental illness when we're saying it as a us versus them. It's so much easier to say she has this problem or he has that problem, but when we talk about it as if it can affect everyone, as if we all need to take care of our mental health, it's so much scarier that way.
Imani Boyette, Center for the Atlanta Dream in the WNBA. Imani, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story, and best of luck with your playing career.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now I'd like to bring Wib Leonard into this conversation. He's a sociology professor at Illinois State University and the author of Sociological Perspective of Sport and Sociology of Media, Fame, and Infamy, Immortality in Sports. Wib, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Welcome.
We just heard from Imani Boyette, and athletes are typically thought to be these strong, unbreakable figures that we look up to in our society. How does that shape the way that we approach the topic of mental health in sports?
Oh, there's no doubt that there is the tie-in. Let me say this at the outset, that I really enjoyed hearing from Imani because you have a case study here of some of the larger social issues that exist. As a sports sociologist, one of the themes that emerges is that sports can be thought of as a microcosm of the larger society. You can't insulate sports from the larger society. You can't isolate it from the larger society. Now, from a statistical standpoint, there are estimates in the larger society anywhere between a fifth and a fourth of adults that are not athletes do have some type of experience with various forms of mental illness. And certainly the athlete is no different. In fact, what my research has suggested is that probably there's at least, my guess is there may even be more, mental illness, in quotes, on the part of the athlete. So the question becomes, why is that the case? And I think there are a number of reasons that both reflect the athlete situation as well as the larger public. First of all, in sports, the masculinity value is so rampant. And when I say masculinity value, I'm talking about, in the old days, we'd talk about the John Wayne syndrome. You keep a stiff upper lip. If you're in pain, if you're experiencing depression or anxiety, you pretty much keep your mouth shut. And so you combine that with the pressure to perform at a phenomenally high level, You combine that with the fact that sometimes we think of the athlete as the contemporary gladiator, the contemporary warrior, and having been an athlete myself in college, one of the things you typically don't want to admit is that you're hurting psychologically, that you're hurting mentally. Unlike, say, a physical injury, if a physical injury takes place, you have an armada of team physicians, athletic trainers, coaches running out to, it could be the floor, it could be the field, it could be the ice rink. And with a physical ailment, often you can see that the bone is broken. You can see that there are bruises. Mental phenomena, mental illness types of activities are hidden. You can't see them. And so unless someone comes forth and maybe takes you by the hand, the tendency is not to admit it. I'm thinking that when I played even in high school, they had a term called gold bricker. A gold bricker was a person that, okay, some type of injury had taken place, but you never wanted to admit that to the coach. You never wanted that to admit that to the trainer, because typically then you became labeled as a person that didn't have mental toughness. And if there's one characteristic that often separates the athlete, particularly the athlete, is that you need to be mentally tough. When the going gets rough, the tough get going type of thing. Mm-hmm. You then combine that with the fact that even though Charles Barkley many years ago said that he didn't want to be a role model, athletes are role models. We put them on a pedestal. And I think most athletes are aware that they're on that pedestal. You combine all of these factors. You combine all of these factors together, and there is this suppression of the athlete being able to admit or wanting to admit that there are these stressors that are involved.
Sure. And we've just got a couple minutes here before we have to take a break, Wib. But if you could talk a little bit about youth sports in particular, maybe, you know, at the high school level, maybe even younger, you know, what can really cause some stress and some mental issues at that level?
There's a concept that we talk about. It's called the Little League Syndrome, for lack of better terms. And often, even at a young age, I have grandchildren that not only are they on traveling teams, not only do they have a personal trainer, we're talking about these organized leagues starting maybe when they're 6 years of age. And so they feel the pressure. I think parents often, you know, want their children to do as well as possible. But the bar, particularly for young kids, is set so high, they experience too much pressure, too much sometimes criticism at a very young age, and it's easy to burn out. And that Little League Syndrome, we see it in a variety of organized sport programs that begin very early. And at this point, from what I observe, I don't see any major changes taking place in the immediate future.
We're talking with Wib Leonard. He's a sociology professor at Illinois State University. We're discussing issues of mental health in athletes, and we'll continue that conversation here on The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're talking about mental health in athletes, and our guest right now, Wib Leonard, sociology professor at Illinois State University. Wib, before the break, we were talking about the stress that athletes face at all levels. When it comes to college and professional sports teams, how much help is typically made available to athletes struggling with these issues?
There are a number of, let's talk about the collegiate level at the moment. Now, increasingly at the collegiate level, sport programs are hiring on sports psychologists. And the role of the sports psychologist is often to deal with some of these mental phenomena that athletes are going through. But my sense is that even when sports psychologists are involved, often the focus is upon maximizing the performance of the athlete. In other words, learning how to relax under pressure, as opposed to saying it is okay if you're experiencing these types of mental events, it's okay to share those. And often, though, the mental side of the athlete, they become so engulfed. I love the concept of role engulfment, particularly as it applies to, say, the college level, where in my case, for example, I'm a professor, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a spouse. But role engulfment, as it applies, I think, to many college athletes, is that one role, that athletic role that they're playing, becomes all-consuming. And it makes me think of a study that was done at the University of Tulsa. And it was a study that some social psychologists did. They wrote a book entitled From Blackboards to Backboards. And these two writers worked in the registration office, and they noted that often when athletes would come in, now they did focus upon basketball, that when they would come in for an interview, they would have these grandiose plans of becoming a doctor, an attorney, a professor, and also an athlete. But in this book, as time went on, they became very realistic. And at those high levels of collegiate sport activities, it's virtually impossible. It's virtually impossible, say, to even combine, say, a good student role with a good athlete role. So something has to give. They become so engulfed in that particular niche that they're playing, and then if something is going wrong mentally, there's so much at stake, all the eggs are in one basket, it becomes very difficult if they are not encouraged. If they are not encouraged, and typically they're not particularly encouraged, to admit some of those frailties.
Yeah. We have time just for one more question here, Wib, maybe about a minute or so left here. If you could, what do you think that athletic organizations and college programs need to do going forward to provide a healthier environment for athletes mentally?
I think one thing that could be done is to certify coaches in particular. I do know that trainers are certified, but often if I think of trainers, they're certified in the more kinesiological aspects, the physical aspects. So I think one thing that could be done is to have a certification program which coaches would attend that would make this very much front stage. There are professional organizations. I'm thinking of professional soccer. They have a number of programs in which they deal with this softer side of what an athlete may be experiencing. I think there are steps that have been taken, but like we often say, we still have a long way to go in order to make that open. And I guess the last thing I would say here is that even as a sports fan myself, I admire people like Ben Roethlisberger, some of these professional athletes. I can remember a few years ago, he was out there with a cast on his foot. And it's like, oh man, this is what it means to be a real person, a real man. And this goes back to something I said earlier about the masculinity, the testosterone aspect of sports, because we often admire those that have gone through phenomenal ordeals. I also think of like the Army Rangers. Oh, I love the Army Rangers.
Yeah.
I also think of the Navy SEALs.
Right.
And I think that gets into the public's mindset.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Wib Leonard, sociology professor at Illinois State University, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
You're welcome.
Last week, we saw the damage a natural disaster could do to a nursing home, with the tragic deaths of 9 people who died after their nursing home near Fort Lauderdale lost power because of Hurricane Irma. Meanwhile, today, Hurricane Maria has slammed Puerto Rico, and a powerful earthquake in the Mexico City area has killed more than 200 people. In late February this year, Illinois was hit by several tornadoes. One of them hit the LaSalle County Nursing Home in Ottawa, about an hour and a half northeast of Peoria. The nearly 70 residents were safely evacuated, but until now, the damage done by the tornado kept the nursing home closed. After natural disasters strike, it takes a lot of work to get life back to normal. And just last week, 7 months after the tornado hit, the LaSalle County Nursing Home has reopened. Chris Cernas is the administrator at the LaSalle County Nursing Home. He spoke with Nyla Boodoo about what it's like to finally get things back up and running.
First, I wonder if you could just remind us how you and your staff got them all to safety. And where did they go after the nursing center was damaged?
Okay. Well, the tornado hit at 4:45 p.m. on February 28th. The staff has always been, they go through in-services, drills. So they were ready for, you know, any tornado or, let's say, fire safety, fire evacuation. So by 4:30, they had the residents in the hallways. And they closed all the draperies, closed the doors and such. And approximately, as I said, 4:45, the tornado hit. All the residents were in the hallway, so they were in safe places. In fact, some of the employees actually draped themselves over the residents, which is really, you think about it, it's, you know, kind of makes your heart ping a little bit just to protect the residents. That was the first hit. After the first hit, it did take part of the roof off or damaged it such that some rain was coming in the hallways. So what we did then is we evacuated the residents from the hallways to a place, it's the activity living room, because there was a talk of another tornado coming. But that other tornado never came. It was... The first one was the one that really hit.
Wow. Yeah.
And again,
so much that your staff went through. But that's also, I imagine, part of the they followed protocol. That's what you're supposed to do in a natural disaster.
They absolutely followed protocol, what they were supposed to do. They were magnificent. They really were. And ironically, at 3:30, about an hour and 15 minutes before the tornado hit, we had a fire drill. You know, what's the irony of that happening? So we had a fire drill, and they did very well.
Oh, and so much work.
An hour later, we had the real
thing. Well, maybe everybody was really ready to go at that point, right,
Chris? They were.
So can you remind us what kind of damage the nursing home facility sustained after the tornado?
Sure. It was extensive, about $1,700,000. The majority of that was the roof. It didn't tear off the roof totally, but it ruined it enough that we had to replace the whole roof. It did knock down some systems. We have our own water system, so we had to revamp that. It did do some damage to the fire drill for the fire alarm system. Our nurse call system was burned out. We also had, of course, a lot of damage on the outside as far as trees and such knocked over. Our gazebo was totally blown away. And then also we had about 18 windows blown out. And then on the second floor, there is just one little section. We have a second floor. It literally did rip the roof, off that off the top of that. You went up there, you saw blue sky.
Oh, my.
So it was pretty extensive, yeah. And we had limbs come through some of the windows. And as the employees described, there was just debris flying everywhere in the air while the tornado was over the facility.
Okay. And so where did you evacuate those folks, those 70 or so folks who were in the nursing home afterwards?
Well, the triage, or actually not triage, but getting them placed out of the facility started approximately 7 o'clock and ended about 1 o'clock the next morning. They were transferred to five or six different facilities. So, in other words, we called up these nursing homes, and they, of course, they were watching the news, and they were very, very accommodating. They actually came out with their transportation vehicles and transported many of our residents to their facilities. And then four of them initially went to a hospital. They had contusions, but then they went to a local nursing home in Mendota, Illinois.
And are they looking forward to moving back in? Has everybody moved back in?
Well, actually, we had to go through the inspections. The roof got delayed as far as the repair work because of a lot of rain. And because of that, we lost 5 weeks. Plus, once we got everything done, it took us 3 weeks to go through all the inspections. So that took 3 weeks. We started taking back residents last week on Tuesday, and then we took a total of 11. And we're going to progress and take 15 per week until we get all the residents back that can come back.
And are folks excited about coming back?
Very excited about coming back. The families are excited. A lot of smiles and such, you know, as they're coming in. And, yes, they're very excited.
Right. We saw on your Facebook page a sign that said, "Welcome home." I think as you, Chris, have been detailing all of the work that goes into rebuilding, it's something, I mean, I know firsthand, having someone who grew up in South Florida and lived through lots of hurricanes, talking to my parents now about Hurricane Irma and how they're recovering, how long the process takes after a natural disaster, and everyone
right.
kind of forgets how long the rebuilding takes, and it's not in the news. And so those, I think everybody kind of forgets how long it takes for all of this to happen. So
right.
I wonder, how are you feeling now that you've gotten through all of this?
Oh, we feel ecstatic, you know, that we can get the residents back. It's just being in this facility. I worked out of this facility for 6 months, and then also at the county complex, and it was so, after some of the other, we had a skeleton crew of employees, it was just like a ghost town here. It was just so eerie not having staff and residents and laughter and such. So, you know, everybody's just feeling, you know, very ecstatic. Even though it's hectic bringing all the residents back, we're all very, very happy. It's a home again, not a ghost town like it was.
And it's a good reminder of how long, as we think about folks in Texas and Florida, how long it takes to recover after a natural disaster.
Well, it took us from the time of the tornado till the time we brought back residents, a little over 6 months. It took us a month right after the tornado to coordinate the contractors in order to get them set up. And then you have to get approval from the insurance company. And then so we started in April with the repairs, but then, as I mentioned earlier, we lost 5 weeks because of the inclement weather, the rain. We had a lot of rain here. So the roof was delayed. Therefore, we couldn't do some of the inside work until we got the roof done. And then it took 3 weeks to get through the inspections.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I'm really glad that all
of
that work has paid off for all of you, that everyone is back home safely at the LaSalle County Nursing Home. Chris Cernas is an administrator there. Chris, thanks for giving us the update. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And that's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, "Ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. The 21st is produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, Bob Holly, and Sean Newman. Technical direction and engineering come from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moldine, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and thanks so much for listening.